You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is Jason Horsley for the New Books Network, talking to Jonathan Leatham about his latest novel, A Gambler's Anatomy. I thought I would actually start with something that I received this morning in an email, because I like things that are just fresh and seem to be, you know, part of what's going on in the present. And this would have made me think of you even if I hadn't been going to talk to you. So I'll just read it to you real quick. It's from this writer, Michael Lesher, who's a very interesting writer. He writes about child abuse in the Orthodox Jewish community, and I spoke to him recently, so we've corresponded. And we were just commiserating over the painful nature of our research. And he wrote this to me. He wrote, "The religious sense points to limits in our experience that we recognize as limits, even though they remain, as it were, impenetrable. We try to perceive our reality as if from a dimension we cannot grasp. Nietzsche recognized that this effort leaves a permanent mark, which is in some sense a disability. Singed by the fire," he wrote, "those who approached it are never again fully intelligible to others."
That's funny you say that, because that's a very interesting sequence of thoughts. And just this morning, the only thing I wrote today was that someone in Denmark, I think it's Denmark, is putting together this very eccentric international lexicon where they're asking writers in all different languages to define words, and then they're publishing the whole thing without translation, so the English will be in English and the, you know, Danish will be in Danish and so forth. And I'm one of the English writers, but they throw you words to define, and he threw me the word oneness. And maybe I should read to you my definition of oneness that I sent him, because I'll get it wrong and it'll be a little bit better if I read you the actual what I sent. But it's completely consonant with what you just quoted me. I wrote, "Oneness is what? The moment you step back to regard it, you betray it, the way the astronauts betrayed humanity, and perhaps even became inhuman by looking at Earth from the moon. Step closer, and it dissolves. O-N-E-N-S, never mind. Oneness isn't. And that was my entry for oneness. But this alien perspective that's fundamentally traumatizing and perhaps divides you from the human realm was in your inbox and my outbox this morning.
Yeah. And that's, not to get stuck on the astronaut thing, you use that as an example, but it's a very powerful one because it's a very non-conformist position, needless to say. And it's very much what Prisoner Infinity is about, now that you put it in those terms, that kind of betrayal of dissociation that relates to space travel and trying to leave the planet. But, without getting sidetracked into that, the larger resonance of what you just said is in something that I was writing in my notes about Agamben's Anatomy, which is, and I will just try and paraphrase myself, that Leesom is forever trying to write about what is not. And I made a comment like something like, it's like you're trying to write and still leave the page blank.
But I like that. Yeah. And or to work by a process of exclusion. I mean, this connects also with, a simpler or less esoteric description might be to try to write outside yourself, which is like the astronaut leaving, it's trying to look at the Earth from the moon, which connects to, the Keatsian idea of the negative capability. Hmm. Have we already discussed this?
I don't know.
But, that the goal of the writer is to write as other than oneself, to get outside into an indefinite voice that's not originating from yourself. And to write what is not. I like the suggestion. And there's also, Bruno as a character is trying to slip the noose of origins of self-definition and trauma into some unfixed position. He's a gambler at a game that he claims to prefer because it's honest. You can always see what's true on a backgammon board. There are no hidden cards. So it's a preference for surfaces.
Right.
As opposed to depths and secrets.
Yeah, that was one of the recurring themes that I stumbled across time and time again, was the juxtaposition of shallow and deep, and also inner and outer. Mm-hmm. And so when you were and then I also hypothesized from that, talking about conscious and unconscious, and the metaphor of the blood is that when he sees his own blood, he faints. So when he sees what's inside of him, as in what is unconscious becomes conscious, he himself becomes unconscious,
right?
Which is what you were describing there as trying to write outside of yourself. It's like a conscious kind of automatic writing whereby you don't actually lose your own awareness of what's happening.
Yeah.
Even though you want to get out of the way of what's happening. And one of the ways, the first question, formal question I had for you relates to this was, to what extent are your novels coded? Because more even than Chronic City, my experience of Gamma's Anatomy, and I don't know how much of this is just me feeling this symbiotic connection to your own unconscious because I've related so much to your writing, but that it seemed to be more the most coded novel of yours, at least since Chronic City that I've read.
Yeah, I'm very interested in that suggestion. Of course, you sent me that link to the Lolita Code and the idea that Nabokov identified with the word code specifically. That documentary about cracking the code of Lolita begins with, as it were, a kind of a confession or a provocation or an invitation from Nabokov to treat his books as codes, because he himself is taking possession of that word. He says, I regard them as codes. And I think that I would prefer to move sideways to some other suggestion. I don't think of them as codes per se, but perhaps more as, I think the word I would choose would be a rebus. Series of images that are, that add up to some other meaning, but are undeniably also themselves. You know, when you look at a puzzle that's in the form of a rebus, it's a series of visual things and plus signs or equal signs. And again, in a sense, everything's something on its face. You know, a hamburger is a hamburger. you know, Berlin is Berlin. And yet the series of things adds up to some other unquantifiable thing in the manner of a rebus, where you're always in the presence of the clue with its own tangible properties. The clue doesn't dissolve just because you're pursuing what the different emblematic presences or situations or set pieces or the iconography of the book is very important to me, you know, as a series of encounters. And most, I'd say, in fact, you know, when I say it's a rebus, I'd say most of my attention goes on, you know, if the rebus is, you know, hamburger plus tumor plus Berlin plus California plus, you know, or minus Singapore, plus hangman's noose, minus, you know, the Haymarket riots. You know, if all of those things are meant to be puzzled over, it is as if you could actually conjugate them and come out with a successful meaning. I spend as much time painting the most dedicated and eloquent hamburger as I can, but making the rebus beautiful and charged with presence, I think that's the best word for it, is as important as the effort I may put into, or the wish I may put in a sense. It's almost more of a kind of a desire, not under my command, that the rebus produce some immense sense of cumulative power and meaning in your conjugation of it, you know, when you put it all together. So whereas a code sounds like once you've cracked the code, the clues dissolve, they become secondary. They're only an avenue or a medium for this other meaning. In the case of a rebus, I mean, you know, let me step sideways again and say this is a rebus with a level of commitment that you might find in my idealization, anyway, of what I do. You might say that this is a rebus painted with the care found in a painting by, you know, René Magritte or Max Ernst, where I want you to be almost overwhelmed by the presence of the clues themselves as experiences, as something that you undergo and abide with and contemplate. You know, I'd like you to be able to kind of walk in and touch the clues and feel that they're so absolutely themselves that, you know, the interpretation is necessary, even if you can never completely arrive at it. The invitation to sit with these things and make them into something complete and total, make a meaning come out at the other end, is made necessary by the beauty with which, or the intensity with which, they're experienced.
That seems like that would be a very delicate balance, because you're describing like making the clues so real that, as in real life, a clue is not just a clue. Like if you find a, you know, a handkerchief on the floor of a murder scene, that might indicate who the killer is, but it's still just a handkerchief, as is what you're saying. And so if the reader got so immersed in the objects that you intend to be clues, they could even forget that they were clues or never even realize that they were clues.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for me, that's why it's a the highest game is to make the book feel like a kind of a life experience where everything is connected to meanings and outcomes that you conclusions or distilled into emotions or reflections. But it's also undergone. It's also embodied.
Mm. I mean, do you forget as a writer? Because the first sense I got from what you were describing there was that, Leesom himself doesn't know what the code means. So,
well,
do you?
I don't. Yeah. I don't have a decisive, preemptive kind of meaning that I'm trying to produce. I myself am going to arrive at it as a form of interpretations of sensations that I'll experience having put these things into the same place. I mean, if the meaning was simple enough to look at in advance, I wouldn't be very driven to write the book, and I wouldn't think the book would convey the sense, the air of discovery or the propositional intensity of an experience where things are, meaning is being produced, not being referred to, but being produced.
Mm-hmm. I would think, I mean, my impression reading Gamma's Anatomy was that this certainly could be read, as your other novels, as a narrative, mm-hmm. as a story, and without any attention trapped by the metaphorical underlayer. I had the opposite experience, and part of the fascination and the confusion and what I wrestle with while reading it and while writing about it is, you know, how much am I spiking the ground of your own novel, or how much am I projecting my own meanings into what I'm doing because I've developed this relationship with your writing. But my experience was that this is all metaphor. Like everything that happened, I found a metaphorical meaning in it, and I didn't have to look very far, at least up to a certain point. There was a certain point in the novel where I lost the metaphoric thread, and I felt lost. I felt abandoned by you, the writer. We can get to that at a certain point, maybe. But certainly for the first two-thirds, almost the first two books, I was just constantly finding this goal. It was like panning for gold, like in the narrative, in the events, it just kept recurring, the same meanings again, but deepening and expanding and becoming more coherent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I like the description, and of course I'm anxious that it feels that it abandoned you at some point. I do want this book to feel turbulent with concentrated meanings under the surface. You know, it's mostly not a very, Bruno himself doesn't have the capacity to think abstractly or, you know, I guess I'd say, you know, philosophically in very sustained ways at all. But so the book should feel that it's asking you to understand what he can't, you know, and commanding your attention in a sense by this anxiety that there's something very important to understand that's elusive. I hope that's there.
Yeah. Would you say that the book was a tragedy?
Yes, I think it's I would actually characterize this book as a horror novel. I mean, if we're looking for sort of the literary genre, I think it's a absurdist existential horror novel, and I can't think of very many places where I would say openly that I intend it to be, you know, to participate in that tradition or that genre, because the expectations that surround horror, you know, apart from my surgery, there isn't enough gore, there isn't enough terror. People are just going to think that I'm trying to participate in something that I'm not, you know, a game that I'm not even trying to play, which is that freaking you out or making you scared. But the descent seems to me one of that's more characteristic of that genre than of the genre of tragedy. It's a trap, and Bruno can't escape the trap. There's some moments where you might hope that he can. Whereas a tragedy, I think, is conducted on slightly other terms.
So, one of the things that was clear, and I think you've already said this about the novel, this is about the, you didn't put it this way, I did, about the pull of the past.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned trauma, which of course is one of my...
Yeah.
Areas of interest, and I did feel that there was some trauma in Bruno's past that wasn't being referred to, and I thought, oh, I must be just imagining that because I see trauma everywhere. But certainly his whole trajectory and momentum seems to be a reaction against something, an attempt to get out of something. And so what you're describing, it seems, is that that's the trap he's in a sense. His attempt to get out of the trap, to get away from the past, is what leads to him becoming fully imprisoned in it.
Well, absolutely. But the way out of the past is, and in this I'm indebted to some terms that were introduced into my thinking by a writer I know I've recommended to you, Lawrence Rickles. The way out of the trap of the past is through successful mourning, you know. And Bruno's attempt is to do what, of course, you know, an addict would traditionally call doing a geographical. He tries to mm-hmm. just step physically out of the traumatic scenario rather than addressing it or mourning it as it requires. And he's hardly alone in this kind of, you know, this is where I think in some important way the book is about Europe and California, about this idea that you can, you know, migrate away from the site of the tomb in which you're implicated.
I have to ask this, not just for vanity's sake, but for honesty's sake. Were you, because in the afterwards Seen Not Seen It, that was written in Berlin, and of course the novel begins in Berlin, and I think you mentioned reading Seen and Not Seen on the train in Europe. So were you working on this novel while you were reading Seen and Not Seen?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I mean, it was where I was thinking about your interpretations of my writing quite a lot as I was, I mean, you could say most simply, this is the first book I've written that has the benefit of your interpretations. Because I was without them until then. So as a fundamental, you know, context, they're present. And I think resonated with my responses to a number of other pieces of, stimulus that I credit with the inception of this book. I was rereading Graham Greene, who I'd read when I was in my, you know, early teenage years. I'd read him at 13, 14, 15, 16, compulsively. I was in Berlin, so I was thinking about the condition of expatriatism, which is partly your own situation.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I began to relate to the idea of a literal expatriate character as opposed to a figurative one. I realized that I'd taken what is always literal in Green, these Englishmen abroad, understanding or not understanding these other places and what those other places have to tell them about who they are and what they've left behind in England. And I began to want to claim this motif in a more literal and direct way, to connect the idea of national identity and trauma, which is also one of your subjects, this, you know, aristocratic, corrupt England that you flee but can't abandon, and the traumatic legacy that you can't resolve that comes from a kind of a decadent backdrop. And also, you know, your alertness to the kind of super charismatic, super corrupt figures that I work with again and again, these kind of Svengali Falstaffs, you know, they're like bad charismatic surrogate fathers. You know, it's something that I have recurrent in the work, and I associate it with influences like Orson Welles' films, Mr. Arkadin and Touch of Evil, but placing that in a more specific, the guru in the background who walks with Bruno on the beach and tells him that he's special and powerful, and then you know, his, when you talk about his unresolved traumas, you know, the influence of that kind of mentorship or sponsorship in his psyche, and then the way he helplessly reproduces that in his relationship with Edgar Falk, you know, who's his sort of manager or handler.
Right.
I think a lot of that connects to your interpretations of Seen and Not Seen, and the other work you were doing around that time that you were drawing my attention to, you know, on your blog.
Well, I mean, that's quite surprising. Probably shouldn't be. It wasn't. There's much more than the validation I was looking for. So, I'll try not to be gobsmacked. The specific thing that I felt reading Gamma's Anatomy was the parallels with my brother of this character.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that much about your brother beyond what your work informs me of, but he's very compelling, and you know, I connect him to other things that have entranced me. I mean, Adam Curtis's series of BBC documentaries called The Mayfair Set that depicts this world of men's, you know, gentlemen's club back rooms in London and how they influenced the arms trade and the, you know, the oil fields in distant lands and so forth, connected, I think, also with, you know, your description of your brother's world and this air of, you know, kind of decadent access. And Bruno himself he's kind of what do you call it? He's like a dandy in the underworld, but he's also a total, you know, not naive. He's like, you know, I also think of, you know, I was consciously and unconsciously reproducing images from your favorite filmmaker, Stanley Kubrick, of course, with Barry Lyndon and Eyes Wide Shut. Those mm-hmm. journeys into the underworld, half understood journeys into the underworld by these naive characters who are not competent to manipulate the aristocrats among whom they find themselves. So yeah, I think that that's probably lurking in there too. You know, there are all sorts of things. This is always the case for me, that if something's good enough or strange enough to get onto the page for me, it's because it's hyper. It's already bearing hyper interpretive, you know, burdens. it's overdetermined, and so you know, Bruno is two or three different people I've known personally growing up, including younger brother of a friend who actually became a professional backgammon hustler at one point, but with whom I've had no contact as an adult. He's Ryan O'Neill in Barry Lyndon. He's Tom Cruise in Eyes Wide Shut. He's your brother. He's, you know, about a dozen other things. To even begin to be something I can write about, he has to be sort of a impossible, capacious container for all of these different things that are stirring and disturbing me.
Hmm. Yeah, well, the line that stands out most strikingly as being a Sebastianism is where Bruno thinks to himself that his sole life accomplishment is his personality.
Mm-hmm, right.
Which is absolutely what dandyism was about in my brother's eyes. Yeah. And what he embodied. And
yeah, but it, you know, in a way, I mean, I obviously your brother's story is a tragic one, but in a way, your brother's accomplishment surpasses Bruno's, because Bruno aspires to that. He flatters himself. Your brother, for what it's worth, and I think you might say very little, he did accomplish an unforgettable personality. Bruno is almost more a kind of a piece of raw canvas on which there are a few jottings. Your brother was a kind of extremely garish painting that hung on a very prominent wall to the amazement and admiration of you know, a great number of people. He was a really extraordinary case of the personality as the life accomplishment. Bruno is a kind of undercooked personality. He's actually better at just occupying that space briefly for people who might fantasize about him for a night or two and then realize he's so underdeveloped that he's not amusing for more than a couple of nights. You either win or lose a lot of money. You might have sex with him, but you know, I think your brother was unforgettable. I think Bruno, seen from the outside, might be terribly forgettable.
Well, even I don't want to say as a literary creation he's forgettable, because that would definitely be the wrong, that would communicate the wrong thing. He's very memorable in the context of the world that you've put him, but as a character, he does seem to be mostly externals, except for what he's wrestling with. So that might seem like a contradiction, because he's wrestling with huge existential problem, but he doesn't seem to be aware of it, perhaps.
He's a self-devised vacuum. He's a mask even before he puts on a mask. And then his existential problem is what to do, having successfully created a vacuity where you ought to have a self, you know? So it's a very uneasy existential problem, because the person isn't deep enough to have one. The problem is, having rendered oneself shallow out of some imperative or necessity, is can you ever be deep enough even to suffer?
So is that the problem then, is that he's not, because I'm just trying to feel my way around this novel, having read it, and as I said, come away with a sense of dissatisfaction, even though I'm haunted by it, and even haunted by the possibility that feeling of being abandoned by the narrative and that feeling of disappointment was actually intrinsic to the narrative, because that was Bruno's experience. but yeah, I'm definitely unsure of what just happened, as I say, having read it and having more than just read it, having, you know, imbued it, not imbued it, the opposite, absorbed it. I even dreamt about it last night. I also dreamt that you sent me another copy, like a new draft. But anyway, coming back to what you were saying, the suffering, do you think that part of what you're describing there then of his trap is his inability to suffer, to really suffer what his condition?
I think that's, I hadn't formulated it until this conversation, but it seems a pretty good name for one of the problems. I mean, you know, so to put it in the light of a book you know very well, you know, he's, I mean, the nearest character to Bruno in my earlier work is obviously Chasen Stedman. I don't know if that came into your thoughts, but it's...
Yeah, very much so.
It's pretty direct. And in a way, you could see this book as an experiment in isolating Chase from the other elements, the other propositions in Chronic City, especially, of course, Perkis Tooth. This is a Chase and Stedman who never gets filled up, for better and worse, with the kind of meaning that a Perkis Tooth insists he experience, including the love that risks tragedy, because when Perkis dies, it's tragic for Chase and Stedman. But Bruno, you know, I mean, in a way, if you look at this book as a satirical re-examination of the Chasen Stedman figure, you know, he's offered a kind of a poor man's Perkis Tooth in The Anarchist.
Mm-hmm.
The slider cook. And he makes as little of him ultimately as, you know, I might believe Chasen Stedman would really make of Perkis Tooth. He can't take it in. And, you know, so I think it's a very despairing book in some ways.
Yeah, I was just going to say that very word. It seems to be soaked in despair. Something you just said is kind of intriguing. Maybe it's just intellectually so, but I think there's more there, which is the idea of taking a character, and as I see it, your characters, and this is always true of writers, but I think it's particularly observable with your work, or some of it, that they're your literary avatars. Mm-hmm. You create a version of yourself, and then you put it into this world. And what you just described there is the idea of taking the same literary avatar and putting him into a different genre, and seeing how that genre. So you took Chase from a sci-fi surrealist, whatever you would call Chronic City, absurdist, social commentary novel, and then you put him into a horror novel, and of course the outcome was far worse.
Yeah, yeah.
In the horror genre,
that was lucky. He's not as, ironically, Chase feels more, but is also, his Teflon works better. Bruno feels less, but his Teflon is completely scraped off.
Yeah, but see, I mean, it seems as though Bruno goes through so much more. Mm-hmm. And I imagine you intended this. It seems as though he's taken through a rite of passage which has the potential to transform him genuinely.
Is that your disappointment, that he wasn't able to be transformed?
I don't think it was simply that, because I'm a realist, and I know that it's like lightning striking in a bottle, that kind of thing, that we can actually somehow open and surrender to events to the extent that we are truly transformed. I think it almost never happens, but so it wasn't simply that, but it was, well, there was an uncertainty of how much you, the author, were, I don't want to say, it's difficult to use words, because it's not in control, because one of the things I love about the way you write is it seems that you're not controlling it. And I can't even say not conscious of, because that's another thing that's nice, is that a lot of the time it seems that you're not quite conscious of what's coming out. But somehow as though, and this is feels risky just saying this, but that you were backed away from something, just as Bruno did. But I couldn't tell if it was you or if it was Bruno or if it was both. So the disappointment actually is inseparable also from a structural one, which I felt that, and I still feel this a few days later, that the action that you pack into the last book or the last 100 pages, there's so much action. And I use, in my notes, I use the dogme term superficial action, which of course means violence and guns. Right. And yeah, all of this stuff is happening after these almost 200 pages of slow build up, but also kind of a searching, metaphorical, surreal narrative where we're really discovering the extent of Bruno's crisis or his existential condition. And then suddenly all this stuff happens. And so it wasn't so much how it came out in terms of it ending the way it ended. It was that I didn't feel the meanings of the experiences that were happening to Bruno were fully communicated. I mean, I felt that, and this is like a weirdly positive criticism, at least it's a lot better than the opposite, that the book was just way too short.
Mm-hmm.
Like I needed another 200 pages extra to explore all of that, what happened to Bruno when he took this wrong step. And just to say something more specific around this, so maybe give you more to respond to, that I began to feel this when Magican is coming, so his anima figure is coming to rejoin him, and right before that he has this the backgammon, the strip backgammon seduction scene with Tina. I wasn't sure at this point, what's Leetham doing? Is the character's going to get saved by the feminine, and that whole felt like a trope, and like, this isn't going to work, or, you know, that's not right. That's not, freedom from identity, which has seemed to be the real goal here that was in sight. And then the actual strip back gown scene was very interesting in retrospect, because when I was reading it, I was thinking, I found the scene really almost horrific.
Mm-hmm.
I found the scene so bleak, and yet, and I think this is part of your art, but you may disagree and say I read it wrong, but it seemed like it was meant to be read as a entertaining sexual seduction scene where Bruno's getting what he wants, but there's actually something really bleak and terrible, like he's taking all the wrong turns,
mm-hmm.
making all the wrong moves.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's sex, it's drugs, it's gambling. This isn't freedom, right? And there is... That does play out. It was. He did fall into a trap there, right?
Well, I think that it's meant paradoxically. I mean, I think that I would say, looking at how I feel about the book afterwards, that Tira is a very, very damaged character who is nevertheless his nearest actual soul companion.
Mm.
But as is often the case with two damaged people who might, in some more ideal scenario, nurture one another, their recognition, their mutual recognition, is both only very partial and mostly takes the form of revulsion and inflicting of damage, you know. But so I think their encounter is somewhat degenerate, but it also is a glimpse of Bruno's missing insides in some way in his experiences with her that doesn't really present itself in any real way with Magician. The fantasy, as you say, the fantasy trope of rescue, angelic rescue, it presents itself with Magician. And if you look at it on the face of it, you know, she should seem like the better prospect. But I think in terms of an actual interrogation of Bruno's existential condition, Tira has something for him, but he can't take it, and possibly she can't give it. It can only be glimpsed in a kind of tormenting, you know, in a haze of, as you say, sex, drugs, and aggression, and cynical intensity. I think you should feel deeply the loss of his contact with Tira after, in a way, Tira is substituted. I mean, after Manchin is substituted, I should say. But it just doesn't mean you're not right that scene should feel like he's being overwhelmed by something terrible, or being drowned in a way in her presence and her aggression. And, you know, and I mean, on the literal symbolic level of the game, the book has a series of game moves. He loses, he has to lose to even glimpse winning, right? To see underneath, he always has to lose the game. And if you conceive that the game is everything, then he can only be devastated by losing the game, even when it allows him to see more. But, you know, we were talking at the very start about the book as a series of, you know, you said, is it a code? And I said, maybe it's a rebus. Well, one of the most, for me, the most charged, you know, images in the rebus is Tira's unremoved cyst on her inner thigh. Defiance about it not having to come out.
I actually missed that one.
It's an intense scene. There's a lot going on. But she reassures him when he finds this weird floating ball of hardness under the skin of her inner thigh that it's okay, she knows it's there, and it doesn't have to come out.
Yeah, and I remember the incident. I just missed it as another piece of code, another clue.
Yeah.
But that's that thing again, yeah, that what's inside needing to come out or not.
But, yeah, I mean, I don't have an answer for you, and I don't know. I certainly know the book is, in a way, designed as a series of very violent anticlimaxes. You know, I mean, the kinds of actions that you see cluttering up that last 100 pages are, whether there's too many of them and it's an error, a compositional error on my part, or not, they're certainly not meant to be satisfying or purgative, or, you know, they're all supposed to deepen your anxiety and frustration, your sense of misplaced, you know, misdirected energy. You know, when Bruno, who's been infuriatingly passive, starts to take actions, they're never the right ones.
Yeah, that's very clear. I think, I mean, maybe I'll be reiterating what I just said, but that for most of the book, or the first two-thirds of the book, there was this sense of almost perfect symbiosis between the themes and the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So everything that was occurring in the narrative was accompanied by a kind of aha, a very subtle, gentle aha of understanding why these things are happening. Mm-hmm. And then I began to lose that sense at a certain point. And so because of that, the narrative became less meaningful. It literally became less meaningful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm still thinking about it and sort of running it through my mind. One thing that occurred to me, whether this is might be completely off, is that, I mean, you were wrestling with much bigger much bigger events in the last part of the book, riots and subterfuge and espionage and counter-espionage, all in this sort of quasi-metaphorical way. Never quite sure how literal it is, although I think it's pretty literal that Stolarski used Bruno as an agent provocateur to achieve some economic end. So one of the strong themes there is, well, I won't put it into words, I'll just put it, the question was, I wondered just today, like, whether some of your disillusionment with Occupy, maybe not specifically, but what Occupy represented, was bleeding into the novel through all of that.
That's a great question. That's a really interesting question. I mean, of course, my experience at Berkeley as a place of calcified or trapped in amber radical possibility predates Occupy specifically. It goes back to my living there in the 80s and 90s. And I suppose that sense of unfulfilled desire for the radical expressivity to add up to something effective connects to later ways in which I wrestled with my ambivalence about Occupy in Dissident Gardens. That's probably right. But of course, this is always a self-accusation above all. It's about the way those radical possibilities are themselves a kind of, you know, as useless as a tumor that gives me insights that I can't, you know, actualize as they live on in the body politic, and they live on in my intimate self-conception as someone who comes from a meaningful place of, you know, critique or dissident abreaction to the status quo, and yet it never seems to be produced in any effective way. It is about as oblique as Bruno's idea of himself as someone with extrasensory powers. Its only result is that he feels less powerful, and no one else is even sure that it's there at all.
Because the description of the events in the last part of the novel, without going into them, it's always difficult to talk about a novel that, you know, other listeners may not have read, and keeping the meaning as general as possible. But what you're describing there, and I say, it seems to be in quite, like, you rush through it, is my feeling, in terms of really, like, understanding the machinery that you're describing. But essentially, it's the whole uprising in Berkeley that Bruno partly instigates and partly jumps on board is manufactured in the interests of Darth Vader, of the elite, which of course is something I've been writing about in terms of my family and social engineering, and essentially perhaps partly why I wasn't able to read Distant Gardens, I don't know, but that I've never really had any, I won't say illusions because that's stacking the deck in my favour, but I've never had any beliefs about the possibility of social change through activism. I've just always felt that the ruling class rule, and that's the way it's always been, and probably the way it always will be. Like, it's a Phil K. Dickian perspective, which I know that you share. Like, perhaps you're divided in that particular way.
Am divided. Yeah. So when you put it so simply, I'm made uncomfortable, but I don't have an answer. I'm only made uncomfortable, so I'm sure I am divided.
And one of the things that in the novel where you again, referring to this, the shallow and the deep, is you equate, or Bruno equates, or discovers perhaps that there's an equation between the shallow with the ruling class and the deep with the mass of disenfranchised poor, which I thought was a very interesting metaphor or an application of a metaphor, because it's not one that had occurred to me and probably doesn't occur to many people. But I think it's true, and it's interesting for me personally, is that, you know, I've extricated myself from the aristocracy as much as I can. I'm still working on the internal, you know, removal of that facial tumor, that identity. But it's becoming more and more manifest, and I've got this thrift store, and my daily dealings are with welfare people. You know, there's rich people in this town, but they don't shop in our store. So essentially I'm dealing with the disenfranchised, and it does feel that there's more life there and there's more depth there, and breadth and everything else, as opposed to this, you know, the point of the pyramid where the supposed I is. It's just like this identity prison that it's just most intensely confining. So that all felt very real and valid in the novel to me. But, and, what happened? Because Bruno himself, he had this discovery that this is where he belonged, was in the underlayer, but he didn't. He didn't find a home there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, is this, I mean, how much of this is... I mean, all of this is you wrestling with something. I know that, because there's just so much blood in the novel. But I don't know how to turn that into question without it just being very pat. But
well, I think it's right that I feel I come from a place that's inaccessible to me, that is immensely poignant, but I find myself only making gestures that divide me from it. You know, the revolutionary idealisms of the counterculture in the 60s, I'm exquisitely sensitive to them because of my attachment and my sense of rootedness in them. But I end up I guess I find them both unsafe and ridiculous for actual intimate application to my life, to my self-construction. Anything you'd see about me looks fairly, you know, normative and bourgeois from the perspective of those idealisms.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of exile, self. You know, constantly self-generating division from a desire that's become displaced from me historically, and practically, and that I keep rehearsing again in the space between Chase and Perkis, right?
How do you mean that?
Well, one part of me is Chase and Stedman conforming to expectations and taking a useful but hollow role in a ongoing charade that I don't feel invested in. And the other part of me is this making this deep fugitive dissident investigation that's doomed, and I can't find the bridge between the two.
And this is you as a writer we're talking about, as well as you as a human being in society.
Probably both, yeah.
Yeah. So, because one of the areas of tension and hence creativity for me in reading you and writing about you is, and our relationship at all, is the difference in status.
Mm-hmm. I know, and this seems to be so defining for you, and seems so, in a sense, because I don't view myself from the outside that way. I just muddle through each day, you know, doing, well, the cliche would be, you know, putting my pants on one leg at a time, feeling lost and distressed, and like, even I've probably spent whatever good you know, goodwill I've earned by now, and I'm at any moment I feel almost certain that I'm back to being a very marginal operator who was mistaken for having the status that you're constantly referring to.
An imposter. I imagine I would feel that way too if it ever happened. But I mean, I brought it up now in terms of the very specifics of the things you're talking about, that your status as a writer means that you can make a living as a writer, and without going into the details, I mean, you are socially very well placed through your writing.
Yeah, my life has been created, the conditions of my current life have been created by my by being recognized for my writing. But I'll quibble, at least to the extent of pointing out that that's usually mistaken for a kind of luxurious financial independence that isn't the truth of my life or most writers' lives. I teach for a living, mm-hmm. and I, as a person who grew up working in used bookstores, and I'm surrounded by used books where you see me now on your screen, right? I'm constantly aware of the ephemerality of literary reputations. They're just basically being plowed under. Thousands of us are being plowed under at any given time into a kind of, it's as if it never occurred, you know, this ocean of the out of print novels by people who had some kind of, you know, recognition, at some point. And so I don't really see it as counting for very much. I'm not even sure I'm in fashion anymore. You may be according me a status that was more true 10 years ago, and may certainly not be at all legible or important, except in a kind of footnote way. Oh yes, at one point they were reading this guy. Mm-hmm. In 40 or 50 or certainly 100 years. So it really doesn't separate us the way you think it does. And, you know, when you dared to ask whether whether seen and not seen had colonized my thinking, I mean, I've only had two and two halves books written about me, because seen and not seen is not all about my work. And there's, you know, there's interesting writing about me in a couple of places, but writers who are remembered forever, who have the real status that you're awarding to me, have 100 books written about them. The only ones we remember are those who generate masses of scholarship because of their unusual sway with critics and scholars, or because of their immense popularity with the public, reading public, which in itself in turn seems to command scholarship. And there's no given that that's the fate of my writing. I could be as briefly fashionable as, and then, you know, forgotten as my own hero, Thomas Berger, who, you know, I know because I care so much about his work. 3 or 4 or maybe 5 books were ever written about his writing. So seen and not seen is one of the only things, and easily one of the most interesting things ever written about what I've done. Why wouldn't it have colonized my thinking? The separation between us in terms of this status is just, it's a construction that you could pick apart, I think, by now much more diligently than you have. I think you have an attachment to it, which is one that I'm interested in and compels me and doesn't, I don't disrespect it. I think that kind of projection or fantasy is something that I actually think about and write about quite a lot myself. What is it to place someone in a constellation of kind of cultural importance and then respond to them on those terms? I mean, it's part of what I'm thinking mm-hmm. about, you know, when I have, you know, someone like Perkis Tooth feeling that, you know, the Rolling Stones song Shattered is a kind of a message and a command to him directly. I feel like you've placed me in the position that Percus Tooth places in the song Shattered, you know, and that dance of fixation and reverence and projection is very meaningful to me. I am a fannish personality.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't mean to discredit your decision to place me in that kind of...
Well, I'm invested in doing so,
yes.
Of course, because I've got your eyes and ears, right? So there's a complicity there, which, of course, as you know, is quite dangerous. And the reason I bring it up now is specifically about the novel, because... and what we were talking about the upper strata and the underlayer,
yes,
and
yes.
Because of course for the rich can say, oh, that's just a projection of the poor, that somehow we're happier than they are, which is probably true, that part, but it is a luxury of being high status to be able to see that as a construction, as opposed to,
of
in
course.
This case,
oh, of course, absolutely, yeah, you don't have, right? You don't have the luxury of seeing that you know, that people. The fact that people sometimes bother me and want to interview me doesn't really change me or my life situation in a very... this takes up some of my time. I mean, no offense,
right?
But I mean, if everyone who wanted to get a little tiny piece of me by, like, you know, sending me a few questions on an email so that they could put it on their website, also sent me $5,000, well, I'd be doing very nicely. But real power comes with money. Real power is that true... you know, 1% luxury. And instead, I'm just a muddler, you know? I mean, I do my own dishes. so I'm just a lot more like you, kind of, you know, making these things, and then I enjoy a kind of strange experience of every now and then stepping into a room where a lot of people feel as you do, that my books accord me a kind of magic status. And believe me, I participate in a very, very luxuriant way in that moment when it occurs. But I'm mostly just a guy at home with my computer and my kids and my wife, you know, doing what I do.
That's the end of the first part of my conversation with Jonathan Leatham, exploring his new novel, A Gambler's Anatomy. You can listen to part two of this conversation at horticulture.com/liminalist. That will be linked in the notes at newbooksnetwork.com. Thanks to Jonathan Leatham and to Marshall Poe for making this podcast possible. You're listening to the music of Origami Conspiracy. I can't tell if I'm awake or dreaming.
spend my days drinking up the coffee.